Welcome to the podcast, Lessons Learned, Wisdom Shared. Think of that person who comes to mind when you hear the word kindness, that person who always greets you with warmth and humility, that person who always tries to make you feel welcome and comfortable, that person who exemplifies the kindness we associate with the consummate family physician. Dr. Christopher Reb Snyder grew up in Asheville, North Carolina, and graduated from Hampton Sydney College and the Medical College of Virginia. He completed his residency at the MCV Family Medicine Program in Fairfax, Virginia. He practiced full-spectrum family medicine, including obstetrics, for 40 years in Leesburg, Virginia, Concord, North Carolina, and finally in Cornelius, North Carolina. He was part of the creation of the very well-known Cabarrus Family Medicine Residency Program and also the Novant Health Family Medicine Residency Program. He served as president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians in 2007-2008. Among his many professional interests is the critical issue of physician wellness. Dr. Snyder retired in 2018. And resides in Rock Hill, South Carolina, with his wife, Joy. They have 5 children and 7 grandchildren. They enjoy traveling and spending time with those grandchildren. Welcome, Dr. Reb Snyder.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm humbled and delighted to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Well, thank you. I appreciate this very much. I want to start off by thanking you, Reb, for not only joining me on the podcast, but I want to thank you for what you have done for me. My introduction of you was, it was not only sincere, but it was very personal. And I don't know if you were aware, but when I was sort of moving through the academy leadership process, you really were a great role model for me. You were always kind to me. You helped me, and I learned very quickly that if I watched you and saw how you conducted yourself, I knew it would benefit me. So, thank you for being a mentor and being a good friend.
Thank you. It's wonderful. Okay, I'm speechless. Thank you.
Well, now there's an important question I've got to ask you to.
Okay.
Is it true that you were largely responsible for hiring Mr. Greg Griggs, our executive of the academy? I got to know the answer to that question.
Yes,
because that's the rumor. That's the rumor.
That is true. Along with Michelle Jones, we were sort of the co-conspirators. But yes, he actually started 2 months before Michelle ended, and I started. But yes, that's true.
So you guys get the credit and the blame. Is that right?
Yes, I'll take both of them.
Yeah, I think it's virtually all credit. Greg was a great, great hire, and he's done great things for our academy. So tell us, Reb, how are you? How's your family? How are things in retirement so far?
Well, I finally started taking the advice I gave all my patients. I've been walking 3 miles a day and eating better and lost 20 pounds. And we're enjoying Rock Hill. And retirement is a procrastinator's paradise. I can do it tomorrow because I don't have anything else to do. So,
procrastinator's paradise. I love it.
Yeah, that's what I am.
That's great. And your grandchildren, are they living close to you?
There's 2 in Rock Hill, 2 in Charlotte, 2 in Fayetteville, and 1 in Hillsboro near Durham. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Those are all very accessible. All right. I read your bio and did not remember that you grew up in Asheville. So tell us a little bit about your childhood and, you know, your first memories of going to the doctor. What was all that like?
Oh, well, I lived there till I was in the sixth grade, and it was loved being in the mountains and doing things outdoors. One of my first recollections of a physician was one night my sister accidentally stuck her thumb in my eye, and I was crying all night. My parents called our doctor and middle of the night, and he came back by Sunday morning. It was Sunday morning, and I'm sure it was just a corneal abrasion, but I was pretty much of a whiner, but everything worked out pretty good. But it was interesting to see that the doctor came to the house. So that was in the old days.
Yeah. Yeah. That was impressive, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, being in the mountains growing up, is that how you got your interest in, you had a lot of interest in wilderness medicine and,
yes,
traveling and, camping and that aspect of medicine. Yeah. That goes back to your childhood.
It does. Yeah. I was a Boy Scout when I was in Asheville, and we moved to Lynchburg, Virginia when I was in the sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice place too. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. When did you develop your interest in becoming a physician, and specifically family medicine? How'd that happen?
In high school, I give you that Minnesota inventory test of 100,000 questions.
Right, right. I remember.
My guidance counselor met with me, and he said, you scored high in being either a minister or a doctor. And I said, well, I don't think I'll be much of a minister, but I did enjoy dissecting that frog in biology. So that started it. And family medicine, it was third year in school. I enjoyed every rotation, like something about it I liked. And family medicine was just beginning to be a wave of popularity, mm-hmm. thanks to Dr. Mayo. And so I just jumped on the wave because I could do a little this, a little that, and still deliver babies because you could. And so that's how it happened.
You know, it's interesting, Reb, the folks we've talked to on this podcast, we've heard that so many times. Folks talk about med school, and they liked everything they did. They liked internal medicine. They liked the intensive care unit. They liked delivering babies. They liked the emergency room. They liked psychiatry. And I've heard that so many times, folks saying they couldn't choose. But then they chose family medicine because of everything that it offered.
Right.
So it's been interesting to hear that so many times. And so you did your residency training. Did you go straight into practice after that?
Yes. Yeah. That was in, Falls Church or Fairfax, Virginia. And mm-hmm. I was moonlighting in a small town called Leesburg in the emergency room in my third year, and got to know the people and the doctors. And, you know, like I say, you start practice within 50 miles of where you train. So that's I'm part of that too.
Mm-hmm. And when you practiced in Virginia for how many years?
About 12 years. Yeah.
What?
I had
wow.
one partner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One partner. He wasn't doing OB, and I was doing it kind of solo. And they came to a point where we weren't getting along. And so I made a geographic solution to a process problem and moved to Mount Pleasant.
Okay.
I joined Alan Dobson and Mark Robinson and Charlie Rhodes. And then with Mark Robinson, started the Cabarrus Family Medicine.
Yeah. Wow. What a strong group you guys were. Wow.
That's some
real giants in family medicine there.
Yeah. I learned a lot from them.
Well, now I was going to ask you this, but I think you've already answered it. And I was going to ask you, on your path to becoming a physician and a family physician, if you hadn't done that, what do you think Reb Snyder would be doing today if he hadn't chosen that? I could see you as a pastor. You certainly have that way about you. What do you think you would have been doing?
I was talking to my wife about this, and I was a blank, big blank. But I think if it were available at the time, I would have ended up in a search and rescue kind of situation. You know,
interesting. Yeah, so going back to that wilderness medicine interest. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Well, I think your patients and your communities are glad you chose what you did. It was the right fit.
Yeah.
So now, Reb, you've been in. So you were in a 2-person group. Then you came to Cabarrus. You were in a larger group. You were in a private practice. You were hospital employed. Right. Like myself and so many others our age, we've been through a lot of different employment situations.
Right.
When you look back on that, what do you see now as the pros and cons of those? And
anything about that
you want to share?
When I had my one partner in Leesburg, we could walk down the hall and make major decisions between patients, and it would be done. We were pretty much on the same wavelength for everything, and so that was nice. We didn't know much about running a business, but we stumbled along. And then being with Alan and Charlie, it was also a private practice, and then the Cabarrus family was still in under the auspices of a private practice. And after I left, then they went with the Atrium. And having a bigger group, it's a little more tender to be able to say everything because so many people are involved. That's where Alan's leadership really kind of pulled things along. And then in Novant, I had the pleasure of hiring Dr. Mark Higdon. And he's very experienced. He had all been a program director. And we just had everything at our disposal to create a residency program. So now that I was employed as a doctor there, so it was a lot of documenting what you did and when you did it and so forth, and a lot of things to answer to before you get the final decision or answer. So but it's they were secure, they had better leverage with contracting to get better reimbursement with insurance companies. So there's good about both. There's good and bad about each one, but
I do think the pendulum is swinging a little bit where, we were getting close to like 3 out of every 4 family physicians in North Carolina was hospital employed. Mm-hmm. And I think the pendulum is swinging back a little bit in the other direction of a little more interest in folks going more independent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, there's pros and cons of each of those. It's a little daunting, I think, for young family physicians to think about being in a small 2-person practice. But, you did it and I did it, and I think it can still be done.
Yes.
Even when people tell you that you can't do it, I think it can be done.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about OB as part of your practice, because you were one of those folks that kept doing OB. We all get trained in it, but most of us don't do it once we get into practice. So What was that like for you, and what was it about obstetrics that made you keep hanging on to that and hit it for so long?
It was one sort of the manual skills and surgical skills. I didn't do C-sections, but just the general OB. And it was the relationships with, you know, people and mothers and families and children, and great way to build your practice from the ground up, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, I sort of had a mental checklist of, well, this person's a higher risk category. Maybe I want them with our other colleagues. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any really trouble getting privileges. I had great backup and friendships with the doctors around, the OB doctors around me. So that made, you know, it made life very, very good. So if I called and needed help, they knew to come. So, yeah, I was doing about maybe three deliveries a month. And I actually didn't, I stopped it after 30 years, really, but it was, I did a lot of deliveries to residents and things. So I kind of count those.
Right, right. Do you have an estimate of how many deliveries you were involved in?
I stopped counting around 800, and that was just in Leesburg, and I think probably about 1,200.
Wow. Wow. That's impressive. Yeah. So Dr. Beatty and I did a podcast between the two of us a few months ago on this, on the topic of referrals. We talked mm-hmm. about the sort of the art and, business and procedures that go into making better referrals to our uh-huh. subspecialist colleagues. And, you know, we actually left out the obstetrics considerations. Neither of mm-hmm. us did obstetrics in practice, but that's sort of a whole different consideration. I guess you sometimes it's during the pregnancy when you recognize the high risk mm-hmm. features, but right. sometimes it's a referral in a hurry. That happens too, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. Now, when I started, it was in the era where you couldn't get a ultrasound in pregnancy unless you had a major problem to get the insurance to cover it. So that it has come a long, long way. So. Just to kind of put that in perspective, but yeah, it's a lot of problems you didn't see until it was quite critical. But with better prenatal care, things became more streamlined, and in a small town, I would say, well, one, is it his day off? I won't call him if it's his day off, or I would try to match the patient's personality to the consultant's personality, if there's a choice. And a lot of times there weren't a choice, but
and in a small community like that, you knew when folks had their day off, didn't you?
Right.
You actually knew that. We've come a long way since then, I guess, but that's important for folks historically to, you know, we think of ultrasound as, well, that's something you can actually do in your office now, right? Point of care, absolutely. Ultrasound. Yeah. We got family physicians doing ultrasounds every day for a variety of reasons, ruling out DVT and looking at the gallbladder. And
Wonderful.
Yeah. But, it, you know, when you and I started and when you were doing obstetrics, as you said, you didn't have the guidance of an ultrasound except special occasions.
Yeah. Yeah. All physical exam.
That part of the doctor-patient relationship that has been forgotten a little bit, right? Listening to the heart and touching the patient, right?
Right.
Before we take a break, Reb, let me ask you about family medicine mm-hmm. in general. You know, we we've come a long way as a specialty. We've made a lot of inroads. We've gained a lot of respect. We, you know, our residency programs have grown thanks to hard work by people like you to get new residency programs off the ground. What are your thoughts on family medicine going forward? Are you optimistic? Are you concerned? And what do you think we need to maybe do a little different for family medicine going into the future?
Well, now that I am a patient, I know that access to care is certainly an important thing. And so we need a lot more family docs. My doctor now is a family doctor in town here. And when you see what the AFP does and the NCAFP, I'm optimistic that we can make the right inroads and the right progress. The electronic records are forever evolving, and they or some eventually will make life useful, make themselves useful. But I'm overall optimistic. And the access to care is sort of the almost, well, one, of course, getting in when you need to be seen. Mm-hmm. But two, being able to reach them and say, what I forgot to ask this question, what to do that and how do you do that? And can you just give me this until I get to see you? You got to know your patients to be able to know what they really need. But I think that would be a nice thing. And you can certainly do it on Epic or electronic records and wait 2 business days. But that would be the thing that would make everybody's life easier if you could just communicate easier, I guess.
Yeah. Access and communication. I guess we learned during COVID. I thought it was interesting that during COVID, we realized that not all care has to be delivered through the door and in the exam room.
Right.
We actually opened up access so patients could not only contact us virtually, but we actually could get paid as family physicians for doing the work that we had been doing for years.
Absolutely.
And take away that somewhat perverse incentive that for every question there has to be an office visit. Right. So I think COVID did teach us some new lessons there. So I guess finally, on the electronic health record, I know people are going to think, listen to this, you and I are dinosaurs, but I say this all the time and people laugh, and I'm actually on a committee with the AAFP, and I said it at our first committee meeting, and I was a little worried I was going to get thrown off the committee, but I actually confess that I actually really like paper charts. And there have been many times in my career when I wish I could go back to paper. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, being the only person in your practice, then you have all your medical records in your brain anyway.
Right.
I grew up almost in the 4x6 card patient records. when we started my first practice, we got a lot of patients from a doctor who died, and it was in the form of a 4x6 card, and there was like 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 of them stapled together, but every bit of information was on it. But then I grew up in the dictation phase, and then it became the electronic records, and we had the worst of both systems until you get enough information in the electronic record. So I kind of aged out right when the electronic records were actually getting to be useful and understood. And of course, now everybody in medical school, all they do is type, and they know those things like we know how to sharpen a pencil, you know. It's just right. The way it is.
Reb, I don't know what year it was, but I came and visited the office, and I'm pretty sure it was in Mount Pleasant, and I met mm-hmm. with Dr. Dobson. It must have been around 83, 84, 85, because I was thinking about that's when I was leaving the faculty and going into practice, and I wanted to see how things were being done up there in Mount Pleasant. And I remember Alan showing me, of course, I had no idea what he was showing me, but it was some kind of computerized system that could, you know, could catalog all the patients and their demographics and, you know, print out list. And of course, I guess that was the very early days of the electronic health record.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I joined them in 91. So, I think it was more of a business, how to run the business electronically than the actual record, because we use paper for a long time.
So, I think it had to do with the patients, their insurance, like you said, the business side, not the pure clinical side of things. But I guess it was a sign of things to come. So, we're going to take a quick break here.
Okay.
We're talking with Dr. Reb Snyder, former president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians, and we'll be back on the other side of this break. I want to take a moment again to thank my co-host on this podcast, Dr. Lee Beatty, and wish him and his family well as they recover from some illness in their family. Hopefully, Dr. Beatty will be back with us soon. And also, for you listeners, if you think of someone you would like to hear on this podcast, or if you would like to join us, please let me know, or let Mr. Greg Griggs with the Academy know. Our email for the podcast is thefamilydoctorpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to talk to you, and we certainly appreciate your feedback. We're back on the podcast now with Dr. Reb Snyder. Dr. Snyder, thanks again for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
I want to take this next little bit of the podcast to ask you about the lessons that you've learned in your years of practice, your years of leadership, and being a physician and a husband and a father and a community citizen. You've worn many hats. Would love to hear some of the lessons that you would like for a medical student, a resident, a young physician, or even us old goats that, you know, we're not too old to learn. So tell me some of your thoughts. What do you remember, and what do you want to impart to the listeners here?
Well, as you know, I've sort of got interested in physician wellness because I needed wellness. And I remember, if you read the literature, about one article a year would be on wellness or aspects of physicians. And now it's everywhere. You can't pick up a journal without some article about it. So that's good. And I kind of divide physician wellness into two buckets. One is the external items. And that comes under the phrase, you can't grow corn in a parking lot. And that's with the system that you're working in, the offices, the mega system, unless they value you, unless they make life easy or better for you to practice medicine, then that's where that can get, you know, start burnout from that. And the internal bucket is individually, mostly unrecognized, the filters you have in your lenses that turn into blinders, that that you need to investigate or understand before you can begin to change your perspective and change your habits so that you don't get burned out. Both of those things require leadership. So you need to lead a system into making those changes that make the practice of medicine streamlined, so you won't burn out, you just can't replace somebody with another body with a warm body and a pulse, you know. So, and family medicine is relationships with your patients and everything. So the system has to realize that that's where they're going to get the benefits of having doctors with good, healthy relationships with patients and get the best outcomes. Now you have to lead yourself out of your pit, so to speak, if what you're doing or expecting to have done is not healthy or not rewarding. And the easiest way to do that is to practice mindfulness and to begin to view yourself as a fly on the wall and in a very non-judgmental way. What did I do? How did this outcome happen from what I did or didn't do? And how can I learn from that? And so leading yourself out of the burnout is also important. And I think one of the best places to be a leader is with the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians to learn what leadership is about and how to do it in a non-authoritarian way. But I think burnout comes from one of the main causes of burnout is isolation. You're in practice, you're busy, you talk to people who aren't happy with you. You're taught to be perfect. You're taught to never fail and to suffer in silence. A lot of us just suffer in silence and until we self-destruct. And then that's just another big ladder to climb. But being part of a community such as the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians and the AAFP, talking with people who, well, they have the same problems I do. Well, great. How did you solve that? Or what do you do? Why is this working? And why can't I get this done? So I think that's just getting rid of the isolation is a great benefit of being in a leadership program like an academy.
Reb, isn't it a paradox that we, as a physician, we end up feeling and being isolated. We're in a practice. We have partners. We have staff. We're in a community. We're seeing patients all day long. We go home to family. Mm-hmm. We're typically involved in other things in the community. We're often recruited to be on every committee, task force, board.
Right.
whether it's school, church, city government. I mean, we're anything but isolated, but we start to feel isolated. I guess it's isolated emotionally. Is that what you found, that we build these sort of walls around ourselves? And
yes.
And it's just a paradox that we're anything but, and yet that's how we become. And that's the path to burnout, right?
Right. Yes. Sometimes the grass is greener on the other side, but sometimes you go over there and you find it's just because they have more fertilizer over there and it doesn't turn out any better. But
yeah, fertilizer, sometimes fertilizer goes by other names too, right?
That's right. So, but sometimes they're like I said, you can't grow corn in the parking lot. So sometimes you just got to say, cut your losses and let's find something better or do something better or build a new way. So,
yeah, Yeah. In your career, Reb, how did, talking about this, how did your family, how did your wife, how did your closest friends play into keeping you well and happy and mindful and keeping things in perspective?
Well, to the extent that I let them, and that's the key. I didn't let them help me much, you know.
Yeah,
until
yeah. We
until
do that.
Things get yeah,
yeah.
Until things something happens, and then you start saying, "Well, gosh, I really do that, don't I?" Or mm-hmm. I am a slob, aren't I? So, and of course, we don't like to be told we're not perfect.
I
started my friends and I started a little group therapy of docs with a psychologist for a year or two, and just laying it on the table and then being told by your friends, hey, you know, that's not good. So, and just being out open to saying, well, I need to change, or I need to do something differently, or it would be better to do it that way. And just getting out of your head and seeing you from a distance and seeing, well, yeah, I don't want to be like that. So.
Wow. Well, that was very courageous, and what a great example to share with physicians. I wish I had done that. I wish I had followed some of those ideas many years ago. It yeah. would have kept me happier and healthier and better. But you know, it's hard to let your guard down. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, golly, I still have trouble opening up my test scores to see what I made in the board recertification. Opening up your soul and your, you know, being honest with colleagues. That's terrifying, but
yes,
it really, it served you well, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And it was a lonely journey. So, and humbling, but, that's part of life. So.
Well, you were ahead of your time with the Academy. 'Cause I remember when I don't know if I had joined the board or was just involved in the Academy, but I remember you speaking to this mm-hmm. when it wasn't in medical economics, every issue. It was, you know, we were seeing the burnout and the problems, but no one really was addressing it or had solutions, and no one was talking about prevention of it. And mm-hmm. I remember you did that, and you really pushed us as an Academy to think about that really hard. So you were ahead of your time.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I do have some other day-by-day lessons that I jotted down.
Yes.
And this is sort of during the day. So I got to the point where before I would enter an exam room, and I would just take one deep breath. It didn't have to be 4 seconds long and 7 seconds, and just a deep breath, one or two. And sometimes I would say, help me be present, or, I didn't have a mantra. I didn't have a prayer. Just take a deep breath. And that would allow me to kind of be present and clear my mind and say, this is who I'm going to be with for the next 15 minutes or so. And I reminded myself that every time I walk into a patient's room, whether it's a new patient or one I've seen 1,000 times, I'm still on a job interview. So I make sure that I greeted them and looked them in the eye, and each person in the room with family members and so forth, before I plop down on the machine. And third, just remember to smile, because nobody wants to see a grumpy doctor who they think looks tired and worn out and just doesn't want to be there and doesn't have time for it. So I kind of do that every time. And I think it made a difference. Another thing that I always try to remember, especially in the old days when you're on call and you get 50 calls over a weekend, try to remember that every call is a cry for help. They're not doing it to annoy me. They're not doing it to harass me. It may be a very unsophisticated call for help. It may be a dishonest call for help. But if you think of it as a cry for help, you may be in a position or a mood or a mindset to be of help. So that's one that I always kind of have to remind myself. And, when the airline flight attendant says, put on your oxygen mask before helping others. That reminds me that self-care is not selfishness. And if you don't take care of yourself, you won't be of any use to anybody else. And so that has also always been a sort of a guiding principle. The balanced life is really a myth. It's a balancing act. And because we're always swaying from one thing to another, one pressure, one thing that has to be done, three things that have to be done at the same time, and we're always swaying back and forth. So it's always out of balance. But if you ask for help and then empower your family, your children, your partners, your staff to help get you back into that more balanced, that's how you have how you manage the balancing act, but it's never going to be static in balance. I used to tell my residents, if I died today, my patients would have a new doctor by tomorrow. So it wouldn't mean they didn't miss me, but you're here for a reason to serve you just can't take it too to heart. You serve your patients, and how we practice medicine will always change because of technology, and why we practice family medicine will never change, and that's to foster that continuous healing relationship that we have with our patients, and that's where you get the payoff from knowing that patient just by looking at them and knowing their temperament and their fears. So those are, and then two more. I think it's Hippocrates said, cure a few, heal many, and comfort all. And I think we kind of stopped short. And we do two out of three, we cure a few, heal many. But that comforting everyone is where you get that continuous healing relationship. And it's not feeling sorry for them. It's not boo-hooing with them. It's just interpreting things so that they can understand it. So, helping them see another perspective, helping them understand their pain, whether it's physical or emotional or mental, and so you walk out of a room and say, "I didn't do anything for them." But if you can think of comfort as the best healing salve, or then you've compensated a lot, and it may not pay off in their lives until later. But physician means teacher, and teachers touch the future. So the things you do may not pay off in the patient's life until later. So, and you may never know it.
Reb, there's so much there's so much wisdom in what you just shared. I want to go back and touch on a couple of things that often don't get attention. And one that you talked about was just that process you went through before you entered the exam room. I think we're encouraged to look over the patient's chart, and as we go in the room, When was their last colonoscopy? When was their last lipid profile? Yeah. When was their tetanus shot? Have they had their flu vaccine? And I know you did that, but what you did was even more. You took your own inventory in a way.
Yeah.
Of, you know, yeah. You know, did something bad just happen? Okay. Now I've got a new patient here. I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm going to get a little cleansing of my mind, and I'm going to be present. So, you know, you weren't just rushing into the room with a checklist of what needs to be done and when. You're going into the room taking care of you so you can take better care of them. I mean, that's really an incredible technique.
Yeah.
And it certainly isn't taught commonly. And you mentioned, you know, the buckets. I mean, that external bucket, the office, the system, the employer, they're typically a lot more interested in that checklist of what needs to be done and when, rather than your own personal inventory. You got to take care of that yourself, right? Because
no
one's going to do that for you. Now, that was...
Yeah. You have to lead yourself. Yeah. And that takes practice. And you got to be forgiving of yourself.
The other thing you mentioned, and gosh, how many times have I been guilty of this? You talked about going into the room and, of course, greeting the patient, making eye contact, recognizing everyone in the room. You know, if it's an elderly patient, you recognize and speak to the child who's with them. But, you know, you go back to making sure you have, you know, you're talking to the patient too, right?
Yeah.
You're not leaving them out of the conversation just because they're 84 years old and maybe don't hear as well. You're addressing everyone. But you said you reminded yourself to smile. You know, because we can have some really terrible days as physicians,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Sometimes it's not even the practice. It's, you know, it's a concern about a child. It can be a whole lot of things. But for the most part, patients aren't there to hear our problem, right? We have to project this, you know, optimism, and you're there for them, and the rest of your world isn't going to interfere with them doing the best job for them and comforting them.
Yeah,
I think that's really great advice. If you smile it appropriately, it says a lot to the patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your blood pressure will go down, your pulse will go down, and you'll be more available.
Yeah. Yeah. And just that pause. I have a colleague in healthcare that here, he's in my community, and he and I've been professional colleagues, well, since I moved back here many, many years ago. And invariably, when I call him or see him on the street and I say, well, how are you doing? His answer is always, I'm doing terrific. And even when I know that he's not, saying that, I think, helps him, but it also helps me. Like, you know, I should remember that the more positive you frame things, you actually make the other person better too.
Right. That's a good point. Excellent point.
I don't do that very well, but because it's so easy just to be too honest. Like, oh boy, what a terrible day. But the more you tell it, you actually feel worse.
good point. So,
I really am drawn to that concept that you touched on about comfort, that you know, that that we that's really maybe the most important thing we do, mm-hmm. is comforting people. And I also really like what you mentioned, that we may walk out of an exam room and we didn't fix anything. We didn't diagnose the problem. We're not even sure we're going to help them. But the patient, you know, we don't know what they take away from that. They may walk away and we have done them a world of good. So we got to remember that it's not always, you can't always grade what you did. You know, it's very subjective and it's very much the patient's emotional well-being.
Yeah. Another good one I learned was the behinder you get, the slower you go. So trying to catch up is just going to, the patient's going to know it. You're going to know it. You're more likely to make a mistake you won't sleep well at night. So, I learned that from an orthopedist in Leesburg. So, now if every day is always late, then that's another problem, but that's a system problem.
Right. So the faster you go, the behinder you get.
That's true.
Right.
That's
okay.
True.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So now that, Reb, these are all just great, great lessons for all of us. But, you know, we're really hoping that med students, residents, physicians entering practice will listen to this podcast and benefit from people like yourself. This has really been, this is very insightful. So glad we could.
Thank you.
We could hear all this.
Well, I'll leave you with this one then. First, do no harm. We all know that. But that includes ourselves, not doing harm to ourselves.
Mm. Very simple and very well said. So very important. Reb, I'm going to, it's interesting. I tried to pick out some quotes for every podcast that will capture the theme of what we're going to talk about and the person that we're talking to. And I found two that I really like. One of them's a little long and one of them's very short, but I couldn't pick one. I got to read them both.
Okay.
And I think these just say it so well. The first one goes like this: self-care is not selfish or self-indulgent. We cannot nurture others from a dry well. We need to take care of our own needs first so that we can give from our surplus, our abundance. When we nurture others from a place of fullness, we feel renewed instead of taken advantage of. It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's what you said. That's what you shared in the last few minutes, precisely. And then the other goes like this: if your compassion does not include yourself, it is incomplete.
Wow.
Your compassion does not include yourself, it is incomplete. I think Reb Snyder could be credited with both of these quotes. and you expressed it so well.
I'm very humble to be part of this, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, I want you to know, I have talked to Greg Griggs in the past week or two. You know, everyone's preparing for Congress of Delegates and FMX. Mm-hmm. And so Academy folks have been meeting, and I want you to know that you're missed, and I want you to know that we all care about you and your family, and hope everyone continues to do well.
Thank you.
And you've meant a lot to me and to many people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel the same way about you. I've always admired your style and your leadership and your ability to speak so eloquently.
Well, Reb, this has been great. Thank you. And again, please take good care of yourself and your family. And it's good to see and hear you again.
Thank you. It's good to see you. Will do.
Please join us next month on the Family Doctor podcast, Lessons Learned, Wisdom Shared, when we talk to another amazing family physician. Until then, take good care of yourself and those you love.